The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Psalm 90. The book of Psalms in the 90th chapter. The God that you and I admire, the God that you and I sing songs about, we just sung three hymns about, the God that you and I are told and we strive to obey, and the God that you and I worship in all of these ways, this God is not bound by space or time. He is known in the Scriptures as the Almighty, and also, a frequent expression we hear, the Eternal, self-existent, meaning He always was, He is, and He always will be. Psalm 90, in the first four verses I'm going to read here, express this very well. A psalm attributed to Moses, likely handed down from generation to generation, finally instituted into the Psalms, where it says, verse 1, Eternal, you have been our dwelling place in all our generations, meaning you are our home, our safety, our safe haven, if you will. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Imagine that. From time everlasting past to time everlasting in the future. You are God. He's the only one that can have that title rightly attributed to Him. It goes on to say, you turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men, speaking about generations, civilizations that have passed, no longer exist, and yet other civilizations spring forth into existence. And then he said, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. Now this is a very, I think, hard concept for us to grasp. Well, perhaps we can grasp the concept, but really understanding the mechanics, the mechanisms, how this actually works, this is something that seems, it's impossible, I think, for the human mind to entirely understand, because in our existence, everything we know of, it has a beginning and it has an end. And so when we think about God having no beginning and no end, your mind kind of goes, and it's like the sprockets start to like kind of go out of sync here. You can't really place it. But once we get over this, once we get over the seemingly impossible existence of God being from eternity and to eternity, a being that is not bound by the laws of thermodynamics, laws that He actually designed and created for the physical world, and we accept the fact that God is timeless, we realize that if there is anyone that has all the time in the world, an expression we're familiar with, it's God. He has all the time in the world. It's certainly not any human being. We might use that expression kind of loosely, but none of us has all the time in the world, do we? He is the one who created the world. He is the one who designed time. And He is timeless. 2 Peter 3. I want to go to 2 Peter to read something where the apostle expounded on this amazing fact of God being everlasting, and 1,000 years in God's timetable being compared to a day. Just a day. This small detail has profound implications. And it has actually helped us to understand the timing of God's plan, what He is doing with the earth and humanity and even the entire universe. 2 Peter 3 and verse 8 says, but beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. So this means much more than God merely having the ability to remember something that happened 1,000 years ago as if it were yesterday. What it means is that God can move through time as he chooses. He could go from one place in the universe to another place in the universe and take decades along in his timetable along the way to do it, but on Earth time, it might only pass a matter of seconds or minutes, perhaps days, whatever he chooses. Now, consider a possible example of this. Christ was raised from the dead, and Christ ascended to heaven after he was raised. This was sometime after he was raised, hours, I should say. It was a matter of hours after he was raised from the dead. He ascended to heaven. Sunday morning is when he ascended to heaven. He was raised long before sunrise. We understand the logistics of what really happened there. And then when Mary came to the tomb, and she came to the tomb before the sun had rose Sunday morning, he had already risen, as the angel said. And when she met Christ, when she realized who she was speaking with, he said, "Don't touch me, for I have not yet ascended to heaven." Well, a short time later, probably, I think it was probably somewhere between 2, 3, maybe 4 hours later, he was seen again. And this time, people touched him. The scriptures say that she fell down at his feet to worship and touched his feet, cleave to him. And he didn't say, "Don't touch me." So it's pretty obvious, well, he ascended to heaven now. You know, he was represented by the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf was offered around 9 a.m. in the morning, and that would be the same time that he ascended to heaven. So this means that he went to heaven and came back, and only a short period of time had passed on the earth. Now, if you think about everything that led up to this, everything that led up to his crucifixion, him being dead in the tomb for 3 days and three nights, his resurrection and his ascension, everything, and what it meant to the Father, the ordeal that he went through, the commitment he made, seeing that commitment through, the diligence he had, and not just what it meant to the Father, but what it meant for all of humanity and even all of creation, the magnitude of this, I suggest that there was likely some kind of grand celebration in heaven when Christ ascended and went back to the Father, the relationship they had now being close again, right one together once again. And this was all because of Christ's remarkable accomplishment and because of the love that God had for the Son, has for the Son, and the love Christ has for the Father. I don't see this as being, and I'm speculating here, but this is not without merit. I don't see this as being, him ascending to heaven and he's kind of like, "Hi, Dad, good to see you. But you know what? I really got to get back. Got to run. I'll catch you on the rebound. Okay, see you in a bit." And he went back down to heaven. I'm sorry, back down to the earth. Now, I suggest that there would have been some time that took place in heaven. Possibly festivities, maybe song and dance and food and what have you. And then, after this was concluded, then he would return to the earth. But all of that taking place, only a matter of hours had passed on the earth. Now someday, the reason I want us to recognize this is because someday those people who are chosen, hopefully it will be you, hopefully it will be I, who are chosen, someday we would be able to do things like that. To not have the constraints of space and time that we do today. But that's certainly not the life that we live now, is it? We are constrained by time. In our modern society, in fact, everything that seems so sped up anymore, most of us live in what has been called a tyranny of the urgent. We're somewhat tyrannized by so many things that have to be taken care of. There's so many things that are urgent in our lives, and we have to manage our lives, therefore, by necessity of what needs to be done day to day. And to do these to-do lists we might have, whether we write them down or just in our mind, they seem to be ongoing, and it seems that more and more gets added to these lists than gets removed from them. Now, it seems that no matter how much we might accomplish in a day, in a week, or a month, we never seem to get caught up, do we? We never are totally on top of things. Everything's taken care of, especially when so many things seemed to take so much time. I was speaking with Michelle about this week. It's like, why do so many things take so much time? Part of the reason I'm going to explain in a minute. But adding to this, the more inventions I think that we have, the more, you know, gadgets and toys and what have you that mankind dreams up, the more things that need to be taken care of, the more time we need to take to manage all of it. And it's gotten to the point, I think, where most people have lost or are losing sight of what is truly important in life. Family, health, and of course, God. An article I had read recently in one magazine took a survey, and they said that nearly 70% of adults in the Chicago area reported experiencing a minimum of one of four challenges to providing healthy meals for their children. Just providing healthy food for their children to eat. And as we know, healthy food requires what? Time. It takes time to prepare these foods. And in some cases, money to purchase healthier foods. But in any case, the top challenges were this. Number one, at the top of the list, most of these people in the survey said the challenge is finding time to sit down for family meals. That's pretty sad. Where people, a family does not seem to have the time to sit down and have a meal with one another. This is something that I think every family should do, even if you're just a family of two. Or even if it's just you and your good friend. These are things that are important. You know, one something that we instituted our family long ago, that we always sit down and at least have dinner together. That's a minimum. Because these are times where we talk. You know, you stay on the same page. You get to, you know, you make sure you know what's going on in each other's lives. And you can talk about your concerns or your hopes or whatever. Just the day. It keeps everybody together. And it's very important to having a family bond and to maintaining family relationships. But that's the number one cause for many parents in this area. And I think this is likely reflective of the entire country, that they just don't have time. They think they don't have time to sit down for a family meal. The second reason was the cost of healthy foods and the time that it takes to prepare healthy foods. Well, again, this takes time. When you get whole foods and natural foods to take care of them, or to prepare them, I should say. The third on the list was the convenience of fast food. So, in other words, it's just so easy. You know, I could spend 45 minutes, an hour, what have you, preparing a meal for my family, or I can drive through Burger King. And this takes like 3 minutes. And I got a whole meal right there. The quality isn't there, is it? The quality of the food isn't there. And so, but they think this is easier. And that's a challenge to them. If that was not so easily readily available, they, you know, maybe they would do something different. But to them, that's a challenge. And they say the fourth reason here was fast food advertising, because they make it look so good. You know, you see those pictures of the sandwiches and the burgers and what have you, all these tacos and these things are just like, wow, you know. And then when you're not, you know, skilled or you don't have a lot of culinary skills, you go like, well, that, you know, my tacos never looked that good. But then, of course, you buy the taco, you get it, and I'm like, this doesn't really look like the picture. In any case, that's a challenge to many people because it's appealing. These things, you look at that, and you go, oh, no, I just want to eat that. I don't want to go home and, you know, slave over a hot stove like it's really slavery, but that's what people would say. I just drive through Taco Bell. That's okay. And but that has become a problem for many families and for the children especially. Because what we get when everything is speeded up, when everything is prepared quickly, when we're on the go all the time, we get a lower quality. Not just of food, you know, this is an example of food, but we get a lower quality of products. We get a lower quality of our efforts, the results of what we put our hand to do when we don't take the necessary time to produce something of quality. And all of this sums up to a lower quality of what? Life. Our life. Suffers. Our entire life suffers by having a lack of time. When people don't take the time to prepare meals, to eat healthy, people will develop bad eating habits. And it's easy to get addicted to eating these things that are salty and sugary and, you know, carbohydrates or what have you. You know, carbs are necessary, but a lot of the foods, the fast foods, they have a lot of empty carbohydrates, which are not good for us. And so in the same area, I read another survey that it wasn't taken by the same people, but it's taken in the same area, that childhood obesity rates were nearly one out of every three kids. One of every three obese in the ages from kindergarten to ninth grade. And it's because of these bad eating habits that are developed. You know, I learned in one of the nutrition class that I had taken in college some years ago that when you eat good, when you eat healthy, there you can eat almost as much as you want, when it, especially when it comes to things like fruits and vegetables. If you want to go on a diet, they said, go on a diet. You know, you can cut proteins or what have you, carbohydrates. But fruits and vegetables, eat all you want. Just eat all you want. It doesn't matter. It's just good for you. You're not going to put on weight from those things. So in any case, other surveys show something similar. In West Virginia, a survey of 7,500 educators, they said that a lack of time was hindering the quality of the education that they provide. A survey of 2,000 doctors cited a lack of time having a significant impact, they say, a significant impact on their ability to engage in research. And when you're a physician and more things are being learned and understood, something you need to be on top of things to give the best quality of care to people is to research, to read reports, but they don't have time to do it. Just got to get people in and out, keep going. It becomes, you know, like a factory. Today, nearly half of all adults, in another survey I read, nearly half of all adults say that they frequently experience stress due to not having enough time during the day. I feel like they can't keep up. I don't have enough time to do everything. And this is not only the result of things that people feel like they have to do, that they must do, because many of the things that take up our time are simply distractions. Not things that we need to do, that we must do, but things that, well, really, we want to do. And this is true not just for people outside of the Church of God. This affects people in the Church of God. And even people just who believe in God. One man put it this way, and I'm going to quote him. He said, "We want to be a saint, but we also want to feel the sensations of sin. We want to be innocent and pure, but we also want to be experienced and taste all of life. We want to serve the needy and have a simple lifestyle, but we also want all the comforts of the wealthy. We want to have the depth that comes with solitude, but we also do not want to miss out on anything. We want to pray, but we also want to watch screens." It's a small wonder, he said, that life is often a trying enterprise and that we are often tired and pathologically overextended. Does any of us feel this way? I know I felt this way at times and do at times. It seems like pathologically overextended. That's a interesting and very well put, I think. It's become almost an illness, I think, in society. Pathology. So God, my point is, God did not create it to be this way. God did not create us, human beings, and give us life so that we would have every waking minute filled with something to do, like we have to be busy all the time. We were created to work. Don't get me wrong. We need to work. We must work. But God made us to work with care, with great care and concern. And any project that we work on, I think, you probably realize this, it is going to be done better. There is going to be higher quality, and we are going to have more positive results if we are not rushing to finish the project so that we can get on with the next one. Ephesians 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Think about this for a minute. God created a sunrise and a sunset. He created it to be beautiful. And I know we've all seen beautiful sunrises and sunsets, but how long did these last? They last quite some time. You know, could be anywhere from 10 minutes to 30 minutes, you know, depending on if there are clouds in the sky and everything, at least on how beautiful it is. Obviously, when there's a little bit of clouds in the sky, it's much more captivating. But I think God did this by design so that they can be enjoyed. How pleasant is it to look at a sunset or a sunrise? But how often do we actually sit and take a few moments, a few minutes, 10 minutes to enjoy it? Or is it just like, oh, that looks so nice, got to get going? I think we all do this because we are caught up in this life, this modern lifestyle, this tyranny of the urgent. But God did not design it to be this way. We were created to work, but not to be so pressed to move from one project to the next. God created seasons. He created cycles of life in the plant world and in the animal kingdom. He designed things that need to be done, yes, but not all the time. That the things need to be done at certain times of the year. And the other things, well, they can wait. You can put those off. You can do those later. You don't have to be on the go all the time. And I'm going to talk more about that in a moment. But the reason that God created life to be enjoyed in a way to where we take time and care to do projects and to build relationships and even our relationship with Him is because the quality of life is enhanced this way. And the quality of our work, the products, the things that we produce are improved. They're much more enjoyable. They're much more beneficial when we take a good amount of time to do it, necessary time. I'm not saying to drag it out and drag it on, but to just, you know, give it quality time. That's a common expression, quality time. But contrary to God's design, what we're doing is we're filling with our lives with so many things that seem like they need to be done, and then we take away time from those things that are very important to us. And we might feel like, well, they can wait. And one of these things is God. People put God on hold. People that believe in God put Him on hold because they understand, well, God's patient. God's merciful. He'll wait for me. I'll just put that off, and I'll take care of this. This is something that I feel needs to be done right now. This is important for the moment. We could put God on the back burner, and we take care of other things. And it's no accident that modern inventions attempt to save us time. We have computers and have gone through the roof as far as their processing abilities and what they can do. And it seems like we're saving time, but what we're doing is we're creating a lot of other things that need to be taken care of with these computers as well. And this is not by accident. This is by design. Consider that the devil, Satan, he deceived and led astray 1/3 of the angels. How did he do it? The scriptures say it was by his merchandising. He was marketing things to them that were attractive, that were distractions away from what they should be doing, what they should be focusing on, those things that are important. And these other things became very important to them, even more important than God. And so when it comes to mankind, we understand Satan still has an influence in this world, a huge influence in this world. And he inspires all kinds of merchandise to be created, and just because they are distractions to us. You know, all kinds of things that appeal to any one of our five senses. These are distractions. And I'm not saying that things should not be enjoyed. There are things that can be enjoyed. But when we have so many of them, we're allowing them to take over our lives, to take so much of our time away from those things that are more important. And so Satan wants to create an environment. An environment where people think they don't have time for building a meaningful relationship with their spouse or their children or with friends or with God. And they think those things can wait. I'll work on that at some point. I'll get to really making a strong bond with my daughter. And then your daughter grows up and she moves out and you're like, I missed it. Opportunity gone. I'll get around to building that relationship with God. I will. He's patient. He'll wait for me. For how long? We don't know. And what has happened in the last few decades is in this country and around the world, and especially many of the modern societies, I'm not talking about some countries that are considered more like third world countries, but to a degree in those as well, greed has become something that is considered good. We see it portrayed in the movies, on television, commercials, what have you. It's a good thing. Anything that's pleasurable is deemed to be acceptable. We should accept it. We're legalizing drugs. Long time ago, pornography became legal. You just accept it. People enjoy it. We market it as acceptable behavior. And then because of this, we see today now, and I gave a sermon about this a couple weeks back, today we have a crisis of integrity in this country and around the world. And the reason is because people are moving further and further away from the ethics of the Bible. And even people, and decades ago, even people that didn't believe in God understood that the ethics that came from the Bible that were the foundation of the laws of this country were good. They're questioning it now. An ex-president calling the Constitution just a piece of paper, as if it doesn't really mean anything anymore. But I want to remind us that despite what the old adage is, we don't have all the time in the world. Each one of us has a limited amount of time on this earth. Each one of us has one life, and that lifespan has an expiration date. We don't know what that date is, but it does have an expiration date. It's not going to last forever. And we need to be reminded by Paul and by God the importance of setting our priorities straight, of taking care of those things that are important first, those things that are going to last, that will have lasting value. Because eventually, if we don't, we are going to run out of time. Like the sands through an hourglass, so are the days of our lives, right? They just keep dropping away. I mean, I never watched that show, but that's the saying from that soap opera. I think my wife used to watch that years ago when she was a teenager for a while. But eventually, sands in an hourglass run out. That's it. Game over. And today I want us to remind us about being diligent in those things that are of lasting value, those things that are going to count for something when there are no more sands in the hourglass. And so let's go back to Psalm 90. I should have had you put a ribbon there. I'm going to read a couple more verses. It's said by many that time is money. But as we know, money can't buy us any more time. Queen Elizabeth I, some of her last words were, "All my possessions for a moment of time." A queen of one of the greatest countries on the earth that ever existed realized, I would get all of it away for more time. Because when life is near its end, a person begins to realize, well, all that we have built, all that we have collected, all that we have gathered or what have you, that's really of no value when there isn't any more time left. You know, the old adage, or something we may have seen on a bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys wins." Slightly humorous, I suppose, but entirely false. He who dies with the most toys did not have his priorities straight. What is true is another saying, very familiar: you can't take it with you. And if we are not focused on the only things that we can take with us, knowledge, character, the character that we build, well, we just might be wasting our precious time on this earth. We live in a world where there are dozens, if not hundreds and thousands of distractions that are taking people away from what is really important in life. When it comes to each of us, people in the Church of God, you know, we might hear a sermon once a week. We come to Sabbath services and we might be reminded, oh yeah, God. Yeah, God. I got to remember that. Got to remember that the rest of the week, right? But how often do we think about God throughout the rest of the week? Or do we just go back to, you know, taking care of things, doing things, and trying to keep up with the Joneses and what have you? you know, outside of the Sabbath. How often, you know, people come to church and they'll open up their Bibles and they'll read scriptures during the sermon. They'll read the Bible, but how often do we open our Bible outside of the Sabbath? Do we just close it and put it away and then it just stays tucked away until next Sabbath? Oh, better get my Bible out again. Here come, oh yeah, God. Got to remember that. And what about applying God's statutes, you know? If we're not opening the Bible, how about applying those things that we learn in His laws? How God expects us to live, our reasonable service, our duty to Him. Are we truly living by them each day? Because if we don't know what they even are, we're not going to apply them. And when we do realize what they are we trying to apply them? Or do we get distracted and say, well, I'll get to that. You know, God's patient. He'll wait. He'll wait for me. I'll get around to it. For how long? How long are we going to put it off? How long is He going to wait? Psalm 90 and verse 10 says that the days of our lives are 70 years. And this is relatively speaking. This is a poetic. This is a psalm. It's a song. Okay, so it's not exactly. Some people have more. Some people have less. But the point is, the days of our lives are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Well, who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. And then he said, so teach us, God, teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days. You know, consider how many days do we actually have? How much time do we have? Well, if we add them up, if God perhaps allows us to have 80 years, that's just over 29,000 days. 29,000 days. And that seems like a lot, especially when you're young. But when you turn 75, you realize, ooh, I got less than 2,000 left. If God allows it, if that's His will, time's running out. I'm running short. And we're limited, so then we begin to prioritize. Many people wait till later in life to be circumspect with the time that we have and to use our days most effectively. But what we are told by God to consider this beforehand, to walk circumspectly beforehand while you have the time, and to use our days effectively and effectively. It applies in both ways. Effectively and effectively, being circumspect. It doesn't mean that we just always have to be busy all the time. Yes, there is work to be done, and there is work that each one of us needs to do. We have responsibilities toward God, family, and toward our employer. But it doesn't mean always being busy, filling our lives with other things that are not really that important. 2 Peter 1, let's go back to 2 Peter, chapter 1. So how do we do this? How do we manage our time best? How do we manage it in the best way? Well, something I've found useful, and I'll just share this with you, and I think this is not unfamiliar, it's very common, is for people to have to-do lists, to have a notepad. You know, I have like 3 or 4 notepads, and I don't use them all at the same time. It's just like people seem to want to throw them away or say, wait a minute, I'll use that. And I write down little to-do lists of things that need to be done each day and each week, and you prioritize them. What's really important? You know, there are some things that you need to do. If your water heater is busted, you need to get that fixed pretty quick. Or your heater isn't working. If I got a, you know, tires needs fixed, or if the engines on our cars on the fritz, these things are important. You need to take care of that. But there are some things, frankly, if we add a list of things that we feel like we need to do each day, I think we'll realize some of those can wait. We can push it off to the next day. You know, you can use a piece of paper for each day, Monday, and then just, well, really, that can wait till Tuesday. And then you get to Tuesday. Well, that's not important. Push it off to Wednesday. Take care of those things that are important first. Get our priorities straight so that, you know, our time is valuable. We should use it wisely. And so I'm not going to tell you exactly what things are important as far as tasks or duties or responsibilities, because that's going to be, it's subjective. That's going to be different for each person. But what I will say is that our priority should be this: God first, family second. And then work is third. Now, all of some of these things can intermingle with one another. You know, when you're taking care of family, it's a part of our responsibility toward God. And when you're working to take care of the family, it's a responsibility toward family. But they kind of commingle at times. But our priority should be God, family, work. That's how it should be. And everything that we do in life should be put in that context. Well, what's important according to God? If one of the things on our to-do list is important according to God, well, we should bump that up. Move it toward the top of the list. Make sure this gets done. Because that's number one. And then, of course, family and work and what have you. And go down the list in this way. And we can learn how to best manage our time by doing this. Management consultant Joseph Juran, he developed a concept of quality control and improvement in the year 1941. And he called it the Pareto Principle. And it states that many outcomes, nearly 80% of consequences, come from 20% of causes. And there are other names for this principle, such as the 80-20 rule or the principle of the factor of sparsity, it's called. But it's roughly described as a power of law or distribution where many natural phenomena actually have been known to display or exhibit such a distribution that 80% of results or consequences come from 20% of the causes. This has become an adage of business where 80% of sales come from 20% of the clients. Now, sadly, in some businesses, what this has caused is salesmen or the efforts of some people in business, they devote more time and effort to the 20%, and then it starts to get out of sync. You know, we shouldn't do that. You know, everybody should get the same quality of service and care, and regardless if they're, you know, what, how much money they might be contributing or paying to the company for their product or for their services. But it's an interesting principle because when we apply it to our time that is spent on the earth, think about how much time we dedicate to God in study and prayer. I think if, you know, we think about it, we might do a lot of study and prayer, and perhaps if, you know, we're retired and we don't have to work at a job 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day, that we might have more time for study and prayer. But I think if we thought about it, those people that are faithful to God, it's probably around 20% of our time in life is spent in study and prayer. And this is going to result in a huge amount of results. Consequences, which are not always bad, consequences can be positive. It's going to result in a great benefit down the road. And so it can be said that the majority of benefits that we will experience, even in this life, the majority of benefits that we will experience can be attributed to 20% of our efforts. But here's the question. Are we putting in that 20%? It's not a lot. God isn't asking a lot. He's asking every waking moment of our life to be dedicated to keeping his law. But he's not saying you have to be studying and praying every day, all day long. Because we can gain a lot in study and prayer if we just spent 20% of our time doing this. It would probably be enough and more than enough. Because it takes time to build strong and meaningful relationships with anyone in life. And I'm talking about God directly, but if you think about the relationships we have with each other and with family, it takes time to have strong bonds and to build relationships. And if we don't put the time into it, well, the relationship is going to be weak and it's going to be, you know, not beneficial to the people involved, and it's not going to endure through adversity when times come, because you or the other person will think, well, this is more important. You know, I don't really have a good relationship with them anyway. I'm going to do this instead. Instead of realizing, no, we have something special here. We need to be dedicated to We need to be there for one another when they need us, and even when they don't. Now, when it comes to our relationship with God, it takes time to pray. It takes time to study. We have to apply ourselves in this way. We live, like I said, every waking minute by God's law. But we have to put in time as well, just building that personal relationship with Him. We understand what He's like by keeping His law. But He shares more of Himself with us when we take time to talk to Him, when we take time to read about Him, to, you know, study to show yourself approved, study to show yourself a good friend. You know, there are a few people in the Bible says He was a friend of God. Noah, a friend of God. Wouldn't that be great if God considered us His friend? Perhaps He does. But the point is, we are guaranteed to have the most benefits of this single life that we have. This limited amount of time is guaranteed to be time well spent if we make an adequate time for God. The Apostle Peter mentioned qualities of a Christian in 2 Peter in chapter 1. He mentioned things like faith, which is much more than just believing. Faith is directly linked to works, of having good works. He had mentioned virtue, you know, being a virtuous individual. He had mentioned having knowledge, being, you know, having temperance. That is, when we, in times when of temptation, we show ourselves to exhibit self-control, perseverance or endurance. He mentioned godliness, which is, you know, being holy, be you holy as He is holy, keeping the next life in mind. And, of course, all of this has direct links to love. But gaining these qualities doesn't all just happen overnight. Look at verse 8 here. Verse 8 through 10. These things are yours, if after mentioning these things, diligence, faith, knowledge, perseverance, godliness, love. He said, these things are yours and abound, and you will neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. For he who lacks these things is short-sighted, even to blindness, and has forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins. And therefore, brethren, be even more diligent to make your calling and election sure. For if you do these things, you will never stumble. So at this time, we're considered candidates, if you will, in an election. We haven't been inducted into office. And the only person that's voting in this race that we are running is God. His vote is the only one that matters. And Peter noted that these are ways to make our calling and our election sure. If we have virtue, if faith, if godliness, knowledge, kindness, all of these qualities of a true believer. Now, one of the first things that Peter mentioned when he gave this list here, he said to give all diligence to these things, having diligence. And diligence is akin to commitment. It is a cousin or akin to dedication, being dedicated. And these are qualities that great men and women of faith have had in order to be considered great. Here's a few worldly examples of putting in the effort, of having diligence, diligently working at something. The famous Roman statesman Cicero practiced speaking before his friends every day for 30 years to perfect his delivery. He was very diligent and became very good at what he had done. Noah Webster labored 36 years writing the Webster Dictionary. And he traveled across the Atlantic twice gathering material. John Milton got up at 4 a.m. every day in order to perfect his epic poem, Paradise Lost, that was written in 10 books. Edward Gibbon spent 26 years writing The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And that volume has been of countless has helped, I should say, countless individuals for decades, understanding the civilization of the Roman Empire and the lessons that can be learned from it, from its rise and fall. Sadly, it seems like people are still not really learning those lessons today, or many are not. But the point is, great works and achievements, they take time. They take diligence, diligent time. And you are one of those great works that God is working with. And we can become something great, but we have to give the due diligence to it. We have to make the effort. And working along with God wholeheartedly, we can do this. And this means not just, you know, dedicating, you know, God's first on the priority list, right? We have to dedicate time to God. But there's family and there is also work. And so it is that we have to be wholehearted in whatever efforts we might choose. And so let's look at Ecclesiastes 9. Ecclesiastes 9, whatever you put your hand to do. I think you know where I'm going. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. One of the wisest men that ever lived came to many great God-inspired conclusions. And he said this in verse 9:9, live joyfully with the wife of whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. So it's talking about the contentment, being content with what God, and something you worked at, wholeheartedly worked at, the relationship that you worked at. Be happy about it. Enjoy it. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. In other words, give it your best. Quality. Give it the time necessary to produce something of quality and of lasting value. Do it with your might, because in the grave, that's it. No more sands in the hourglass. So this is stated, of course, in the context of a person that reveres God. And when we understand that God expects quality, he expects us to have integrity in everything that we do and to treat people fairly. Every activity in life is placed within this context, therefore, of having respect or reverence to God. God first. That affects everything else that we do. We've all heard the expression to work like you're working for God. And the reason is because God is watching. He understands how we work. He understands if we're actually putting in the effort and doing all that we can, or if we're just going, it's good enough for him. Nobody's going to see that. Just put some duct tape over it. It's okay. Sweep it under the rug, you know. Very familiar expression. We've all heard those types of expressions, and he's watching. He knows what kind of efforts that we're making in work and in family. And in this way, he knows what kind of efforts would we make if we were actually working for him. You know, he who's faithful in the least will be faithful in much. We should put this this principle, apply it to what we're doing. Because it's showing God how are we going to act? What are we going to do if he chooses to put us? Are we all of a sudden, everything changes now. Now I'll be really faithful, God. Now I will give it the time and the effort necessary if I'm working for you, God. You see, we're not going to even have that opportunity if we don't do it now. So if we choose to be a cabinet maker, we do the best job that we can. We learn all the skills of the trade and try to produce the best quality that we can. If we're going to get married, we give the marriage all that we got. Put the time and the effort into that relationship. If we're going to follow God, read the book. Pray to him. Talk to him. You know, build that relationship. Ezekiel said, well, if Baal's God, follow him. But if God is God, why don't you do what God says? Because a lot of people say they believe in God, but they're not doing what he says. Or not all of what he says. They'll do part of it, some of it, whatever fits their lifestyle, but not everything. We have to have total commitment here. Dedication. Perseverance. Too many people, I think, get a job and they'll do it half-heartedly. And this may have a few reasons. Perhaps it's really not the job we want. You know, we don't want to work at McDonald's. It's just, we need the money. It pays the bills. And so, I get a job, but I really don't like being here. And you kind of feel this when you go into some of these places and talk to people. You can tell if they're really, making an effort to do a good job or not. Some people, they don't really care that much, but it's just a job. But, hey, think of it this way. It's a job. This is a chance to show myself, a chance to show my quality. Because who's going to get the raise? Who's going to get promoted? Who's going to be the one that the boss goes to and says, I can trust this person? The person that's kind of like, I really don't like being here. Or the person's going, what can I do? What can I do for you? Let's get the job done. Let's do it. I'm here. That's what I'm here for. And does it happily, you know? We don't always, not everybody wants to clean the restrooms, but why not? Somebody has to do it. Is it below us? We think, I'm better than that. I don't want to do that. Or, hey, I can rely on Terry to do that. He'll do, you know, whatever I ask him. He's the one I want to be working with me. How about that? All of a sudden, next thing you know, a couple years down the road, all of a sudden you're the assistant manager because we put in the time. We put in the effort. Even in the Church of God, as I had mentioned, people might go to church, they bring the Bibles, they open them up for the sermon, then we put it away, don't open up again till next Sabbath. That's not doing everything with all our might. As Solomon encouraged us, by the inspiration of God, encouraging us to do everything with all your might. But when we give a trade our best, when we give God our best, when we give him the kind of effort that he deserves, it's going to pay off. It'll pay off in a trade. If you get a job and there's something you want to learn a trade, and you put your whole heart into it, you become what? A professional at that trade. You become one of the best doing that job. And people will pay for that. They want people that are the best at their job. When it comes time for a need for that, making cabinets, what have you, they want people that really know what they're doing and put the time and the quality into their trade. And they'll seek those people out. If we give the best of ourselves to the relationship in a marriage or with a friend, if we put in the effort, it's going to be a good relationship. We're going to be happy with it. We're going to be happy with the interaction, the results of that. And if we give God our best, hear the siren going by, I can see it. If we give God our best, then God, he's going to give the best back to us. It's not going to always be right now. We're not going to always see the results of our efforts right now. But eventually, it will come in due time. Colossians chapter 4. So much time of, or I should say, so much of people's time in this life seems to be wasted. And that's another expression that we hear frequently. You know, we might be sitting around and standing around, nothing to do, and we'll say, well, we're just wasting time, waiting for something to happen. You know, sometimes we have no choice in this, but we should never waste time. Don't put it in that category. You know, there's always something we can do. We could all, you know, there are, I have a pocket Bible, and frankly, I rarely open it because I don't really have a need to open it, but it's really small. I think it's only the New Testament, I guess, depending on if you want it old or new. But that's something you keep in the glove compartment of your car or when you go to some place and you're like, nah, I just have to sit here and wait. You can bring some of the booklets. You know, the churches, we produce like almost 50 books and booklets to pick a couple subjects that you want to know something better about. Take those, put them in your car. If there's ever a time where you feel like, oh, I got to see her and waste time for a half an hour, don't waste it. There's something we can do. Too many people will go, yeah, I got my device. I'll just go on that instead. And I understand there are Bible apps. You can use those. There are some things that can be helpful on devices. But too many times I think people go, well, I'm just going to go on Facebook and waste an hour or two here. And it's much of the time it's wasted just flipping through all of these feeds and playing games or what have you. And there's nothing wrong with playing occasionally games, of course. I think that's something, and I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. But it doesn't mean that we should always be busy, that we need to fill our lives with all kinds of things to do and always make sure that we're being productive every waking moment of our lives, because we do need time to rest. We do need time to reflect on life, on things that we might be experiencing, something we learned, or just to do nothing. To just let your mind kind of think about, to process things. We want to use our time wisely. And we want time to live. And for us to truly live, we have to live in that time. Be circumspect. Colossians 4 and verse 5, another reminder of this, saying to walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. So walking in wisdom is more than knowledge, because wisdom is truly an application of something we learned or know, something, the knowledge we gained. When we apply it and we use it, we become wise in this way. So this means to be prudent, to be sensible about the knowledge that we have. So does it make sense to spend 4 hours a day looking at a screen, but we might spend like 4 minutes a day praying to God, or opening the Bible, reading the Bible? Well, that might seem okay to some people. Some people could think, yeah, that sounds about right. It's because we've created, you know, this lifestyle. We're getting sucked into it, where those things don't seem to have as much value to many people anymore. So to God, it's unreasonable. And we have to be reasonable. We have to have a reasonable service, as we've heard so many times, that we perform in life, whether it's to our spouse, to our family, and especially to God. So when we come before Him, think about this. When we come before God, or if we come before God, and He asks us, how come you didn't give me a little more of your time? What would we say? How would we respond to that? How come you didn't take time to read this part? How come you didn't talk to me more often? How would we respond to that? I don't think we... What could we say? I just didn't. It's not a really good answer. I think that's really all we could say. Would we really... Well, you know, I really had to, you know, get on Facebook and see what my friends in Nevada are doing, or I had to... No, we know it's not a good excuse, so we wouldn't use it. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want that to happen to any one of us. So we have to be sensible. Do things, you know, have our priorities straight. Mark chapter 6. You know, for many of us, a lot of our lives are filled with things that seem to be of necessity, and many of them probably are. But something I thought about this morning after, you know, going through and writing this sermon was, some of us have a list of things to do that really are things that need to be done. They do. And what do you do when that list just seems to be full all the time? And you're almost like, you know, this tyranny of urgency is really gets to you. My answer seems simple, and for some people maybe it will be, but prioritize. Because some of these things we say, well, this really needs to be done. Well, before when? Before tomorrow? Before next week? Or before January? You know, Think about it, because I know we all want to be productive, and I want to get it done just so I have it off of my plate, and it's out of the way, and then I can focus on something else. Well, guess what? Something else will take its place. So think about what needs to be done, and use that priority: God, family, work. And if we're not prioritizing here for God or for family, then we need to reprioritize our lives and think about, okay, well, let's make sure we take care of God. Probably not such a great expression, but take care of our responsibility toward God, and then move down the list. It can be very helpful. It might be easier said than done, because I think a lot of us, we've fallen into this rut, if you will, of needing to do things. Things just keep coming. We're like, I got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. And they'll just keep coming. So we have to say, well, wait a minute. I'm limited on time. I don't have, more than 24 hours, and less than, you got to sleep. And how old am I? I might be running out of time. Let's get our priorities straight before the hourglass runs out. And in all of this, we need to be productive, and productivity and efficiency, these things are important, don't get me wrong. But I think this has become of such value in our modern, speeded-up world that people fall into another ditch. That is, they fill their lives with so much to do that they don't have, not only do they not have time for God, well, many people don't have time even for themselves. And this really affects their physically, affects them physically and mentally. And so we need time, actually, for God, and we need time also for ourselves. We need time to unwind, don't we? Some studies I've read recently say that times of pause, reflection, and meditation, meditation can come in several forms. It's not just sitting in a room quiet with no noises and no distractions and closing your eyes. There are other ways you can meditate, whether it's taking a walk and meditating and thinking while you're walking, or going to a location that's kind of beautiful where you can just kind of look at the trees or what have you. Or if you're in your house in the dead of winter, you can meditate in your house as well. But anyway, one study says times of reflection and meditation have proven to strengthen your memory. We watched a program about this the other day. Remember that program called The Mind Explained? And to talk to people that are just have like astounding memories. And one of the top things they said, got to take time to reflect, to meditate. It's a huge factor for them. Several clinical studies showed that meditation reduces anxiety and helps people to deal with stress more easily and to have a better outcome. It has even been proven, and we've probably mentioned this in the past, but it's been proven that regular meditation or reflection, times to unwind, taking a walk, watching a sunset, what have you, that these actually help the body to be more resistant to disease and illness and to fight it off more quickly if somebody does become ill. Now, something that I have found helpful on a regular basis is when you take like a half hour walk. This can be done when on your lunch break, or if we have a job outside the home or whatever, mandatory, you're supposed to take breaks. And our employers would like it if we did not, but legally you're allowed to take a break and you need to. And what I would do is I would just leave the office and just walk around downtown for a little while and then come back. And it's really helpful. It is very helpful. It helps us to actually, process our thoughts. We see things a little more clearly. We might come to conclusions about something that we are wondering about, or perhaps even finding solutions to something that was troubling us. This has happened to me many, many times on these short walks, talking to God about things and then thinking about things. We don't have to have our neurons constantly firing and be busy all day long in order to be prudent. And the body, in fact, wasn't designed to work like this constantly. We need to have times to pause and to reflect so that the synapses in our mind can make connections with one another. How many times has any of us experienced this, where you're like meditating, thinking, taking a walk, or just, you know, just sitting and reflecting, and then, it comes. And it seems like, wow, that was so simple. The answer was right there. How come I didn't see it? Maybe we didn't take the time to sit back and relax and just really let these things process for a little while. So as an example, Christ worked hard. He worked hard from a youth. He knew what hard work was. He became a man who was referred to as a carpenter in the scriptures. What that word term really means is a worker with hands. I think he would be compared more to like a contractor in our age. But he knew how to work hard, and he did work. He did what needed to be done, and even more. He went above and beyond what needed to be done. But he also knew that there was a time for physical rest, and he knew that there was a time for mental rest, a time to reflect and to reconnect with God. And so it was that he was a human being, and he understood the way the body was designed. And so an example of this is in Mark 6. Mark 6, and this is after he and the disciples had fed more than 5,000 people, a great deal of work. Mark 6 and verse 45 says, immediately he made his disciples get into a boat and go before him to the other side of Bethsaida. And while he sent the multitudes away, and then he when he had sent them away, he, by himself, departed to the mountain to pray. And now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. And so we see that there was a great deal of time that took place here between when he sent them away and they went out to the boat and went out to the middle of the sea, and he was still on the land in the evening. And you say, spend hours alone in deep thought, likely praying to God much of the time. And so he understood that this is the way that the body was designed, that the mind actually would work at its best when there are times of respite, times to pause and to reflect. It's not necessarily a time out, but it's a break. It's a time where we regather our thoughts. You know, we've heard that expression, let me gather my thoughts for a moment. We might do this frequently when we're working on a project where you stop to, wait a minute, let me think this through. Okay, here's how it should work. I'm talking about something that's even greater, taking it to another level of gathering your thoughts, and something referred to as meditation. John 12, so personal time that should be included in our lives, having time alone. But we can, these times of meditation and reflection, you can do with other people, people you care about, people that you love, whether it's a spouse or a family member or a friend. And this leads to something else that is very important, I think. It's time that's spent with loved ones. You know, we need to take time out to spend with the people that we care about, with our spouse. We need to take time to spend with them alone, not just in the bedroom. We need to take time to date them. You know, go out for a meal together, take a walk together, go on a bike ride together, go for a drive together, park and watch a sunset together. These are very important moments in our lives that helps us to build and to strengthen that relationship, and also to reconfirm that relationship, letting them know, hey, we still care. I'm not just taking advantage of you because you're cooking all my meals, or because you're going off to work all day long to make money. That we want to reconfirm that I still care and I still deeply love you. It helps to keep relationships strong and healthy when we spend personal time with each other. And time spent with children, if we have children, this is also something that's very important. We should take time to be with them alone. And, as our children grow and become older, I know you girls can relate to this, when they become older teens, you know, they don't really want that as much. They don't want the, we used to have daddy and daughter days where I would take each one of them out and we'd do something together. They didn't really care about that much anymore, but I still want to do it. And, when they're open to it, I still attempt to spend time with them. But this is important because it shows them that we really care about them, that we really care about them as individuals deeply, not just that we're simply fulfilling our duties as parents, providing shelter and food and clothing, but we care about them as a person, as an individual. We care about what they care about, that we want to know, what are your thoughts? How does this make you feel? How could we help it? How can we, be further nurturing you to be ready to go out into the world? There was a poem I read recently called No Time to Play, and I'd like to share it with you. I'm not sure who the author is. In any case, this poem says, "My precious boy with the golden hair came up one day beside my chair and fell upon his bended knee and said, 'Oh, Mommy, please play with me.' I said, 'Not now, go on and play. I've got so much to do today.' He smiled through tears and his eyes so blue when I said, 'We'll play when I get through.' But the chores lasted all through the day, and I never did find time to play. When supper was over and dishes done, I was much too tired for my little son. I tucked him in and kissed his cheek and watched my angel fall asleep. As I tossed and turned upon my bed, those words kept ringing in my head. 'Not now, son. Go on and play. I've got so much to do today.' I fell asleep in a minute's span. Now my little boy is a full-grown man. No toys are there to clutter the floor, no dirty fingerprints on the door. No snacks to fix, no tears to dry. The rooms just echo my lonely sigh. And now I've got the time to play. But my precious boy is gone away." I awoke myself with a pitiful scream and realized it was just a dream. For across the room in his little bed lay my curly-haired boy, the sleepy head. My work will wait till another day, for now I must find some time to play. We need time to play. We should play, even if we're like, that's not my favorite game, chutes and ladders, Monopoly. But they like it, they enjoy it, and we do enjoy it when we do it with them, don't we? It's kind of fun, because it's not just the game, it's the person. It's the relationship. That's what we enjoy, the time together. And we want to hang on to that. We want to strengthen that and make it something that is going to last, because it is going to be helpful for them and for us and the future. So building meaningful relationships takes time. And anything worthwhile in life takes time. And that is what you and I have right now. We have moments of time. But eventually our time is going to be up, because in a world where time marches on, we cannot stop the clock and say, wait a minute, I need to do this. No, the clock is going to keep ticking. So we need to manage our time so that we can cover all of these bases and we can use our time wisely. And in these ways, this is what I think Paul, Peter, what they talked about when they said, redeem the time. Redeeming the time. Because now is our window of opportunity. It's a window of opportunity that has not opened to everyone. But how long will it stay open? How much time do we have left? We don't know. It seems certain that end time events are being orchestrated, and we know that there is much that still needs to happen before Christ returns, but we also know that it could happen rather quickly once these things begin. So when it does, the window of opportunity that many of us have right now, well, that is going to be closed. And the Bible illustrates this as with Christ saying that people will be weeping and gnashing their teeth because of what they missed out on. Christ gave another illustration making this point in John 12. John 12, verse 35, Jesus said to them, speaking to the disciples, something that relates directly to us as well, "A little while longer and the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of the light. And Jesus spoke these things, and then he departed from there. So Christ encouraged people to walk while you have the light. Now, Christ is not walking the earth today. He isn't, you know, this isn't, he said this to those people when his ministry was actively taking place with him being there in person. That's not happening today, but he is still a light to us in spirit and by his spirit, even the spirit of truth. And in this way, we do have light, don't we? And we can walk in the light in this way. It's a green tree right now, if you think about it. There are many things that are at our fingertips, things that we can take advantage of. We can go freely to Sabbath services at this time. We're not restricted in meeting with one another and talking about God and worshiping God together. We can pick and choose videos and sermons and Bible studies to listen to or to watch. There are CDs, there are booklets, there are MP3s, there are all kinds of study material is out there and available for people to benefit from right now. And Christ is in many of these places. And in this way, it's a light. It's a light to help bring God's people out of darkness. But for how much longer? How much longer will all of this be accessible to us? Let's go to Amos 8. Amos in chapter 8. And we will conclude over here. The prophet Isaiah spoke of a time when God would not be found by many, and he encouraged people to seek the Eternal while he may be found, to call upon his name while he is near. So if darkness is further encroaching on the earth as the love of many grows cold and iniquity abounds today, and with the darkness that is growing thicker and stronger at this time will come famine. Famine not just of food and of water, that's not what I'm talking about, but a famine of the Word of God. Now let's read this here in Amos 8. Amos 8 and verse 9. Speaking of the last days, it shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal God, that I will make the sun go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the broad daylight. So it's talking about end time events here. I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs into lamentation. And I will bring sackcloth on every waist and baldness on every head. I will make it like mourning for an only son, like your only child died, and its end like a bitter day. And then he said, behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal God, that I will send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Eternal. And they shall wander from sea to sea and from north to east and run to and fro, which is exactly what's happening today, seeking the word of the Eternal, but you shall not find it. So I'm not saying that this famine of the word has happened. What I'm saying is it has not happened yet, but it will happen. It is going to come because God's going to say what? Time's up. He who is faithful, let him be faithful still. He who is guilty, let him be guilty still. Time's up. Now, Christ said that many in the church of God will be caught off guard when he comes. And he described it like him coming like a thief in the night, that he'll show up unexpectedly. We'll think we're okay, things are fine, we're ready. We know all we need to know, it's okay. God's merciful, he's forgiving, he's patient. It's okay, I got all I need. But he said, nope, I'm going to come like a thief in the night. You're not going to expect it. And people will not be prepared. He also illustrated it in the book of Revelation and the letter to Laodicea as him spewing people out of his mouth into the fiery tribulation. So there will be a famine of the word throughout most of the world at that time. And the access that you and I have to God and to the church and to the truth will not be available to everyone like it is today. People will look for it. Won't be found because God will have already made his decision. God will be available to some, but it is only going to be those people who will be taken to a place of safety and perhaps some that might be martyred in the tribulation. But he is going, my point is, he is going to be readily available continually to those people who are redeeming the time today, to those people who have their priorities straight, to those people who are walking circumspectly. Now, Paul wrote in the book of Romans that the night is far spent, that the day is at hand. And he said, it's high time to awake out of your sleep. For our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. Now, he wrote this nearly 2,000 years ago. How much more does it apply to us today? I think, in all likelihood, it is more relevant to us today than it ever has been. That the night is far spent, and the day is nearly at hand. So let's remember some of these things, some of these points. Hopefully they can be helpful. The 80-20 rule that we need to put in a decent amount of time to God every day. In Bible study, in prayer, that our priorities need to be straight. God, family, work. That we can make to-do lists, prioritize these lists according to those priorities. And that we need to make time for family, for friends, even people in the church. Make time for each other. And we also need to take time to rest, time to reflect, time to wind down, to unwind, and time to have fun. God designed life to be fun. Have a little fun once in a while without neglecting our responsibilities, of course. It's all a matter of priority. And in these ways, we can be rest assured that when it's time for Christ to come, that we will have the qualities that he is looking for, the qualities of a good and faithful servant who has redeemed the time that we have only, relatively speaking, a small amount of at this time. And we won't be left thinking, if we just had a little bit more time, just a little more time, hopefully that won't happen and we'll realize, hey, we had all the time we needed and we got it done.